Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 713, Interview with Russ Baker. This broadcast is being recorded on Memorial Day of 2010, May 31st. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and The Hidden History of the Last 50 Years, just out in softcover by the Bloomsbury Press. Russ, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
I'm going to leave it open to you if we could begin this broadcast. We've already done two interviews, and we've talked about the Bush family's operations, the networking, the synthesis of corporate and intelligence, as in espionage, not intellect matters. And in the last interview, we talked about the events of Dallas, Texas, November 22nd, 1963. Do you think it's even possible? Would you like to attempt to encapsulate or synopsize or otherwise make somewhat familiar to people who may not have heard those interviews, given that this is past a point impossible?
Let me pull back the camera for a moment and just explain very briefly that the book, Family of Secrets, which is a history of the Bush family, but also a history of this country, of events, very, very powerful, very important and formative events that are unrecorded or unknown by the populace in general and really by just about everybody, except for the people who were involved, and they're still keeping the secrets. And the way I came to do this book was I simply wondered how it was that someone as controversial and seemingly ill-equipped for the job as George W. Bush should be able to become president of the United States and the most powerful person in the world. And I went about my mission with no particular agenda. I did not know what I would find, and I was open to anything. And in the course of 5 years of research for what became Family of Secrets, I discovered an endless number of secrets. That's why it's in the title, secrets small and secrets large. And one of the things I discovered was that there was a back history to the Bush family's rise, both to the son and to the father, and moreover to, let's say, the power manifestation of certain elite circles of which they were part. And that really is what the book is about. And so I begin looking at the son. I discover that, very importantly, the son and the father were much closer and more consultative than is characterized in other books. And I discovered that the father was much more important to understanding the son. And so I began looking at the father. I discovered that the father, too, was improbable to have become the most powerful person in the world. And so I began focusing first on the father. And as we discussed in the previous programs, I learned that the father had what amounted to a secret life, that long before he was named CIA director as a supposed neophyte, that he actually had a secret past with intelligence work going back decades. And this took us then through a number of traumatic episodes in U.S. history, through the Cold War and up until the early 1960s, where I discovered, much to my astonishment, that there was much more to the JFK assassination and the Oswald narrative than I had realized or than is characterized in any other books. And this involved the activities of a group of people surrounding and including George H.W. Bush relative to what took place in Dallas that day. And so in an earlier program, we went through the staggering array of activities, deceptions, incidents, and so forth relating to Mr. Bush and his circle and the CIA and their allies and the military and so forth. And this gives us a whole different understanding of what that was about. And I think that pretty much brings us up to where we are.
And, of course, it is said that everyone who was of the age of consciousness on 11-22-63 knew where they were and what they were doing. Ostensibly, that does not involve George Bush, who appears to have been in Dallas, certainly the night before and very possibly on that very day, but has dissembled, including dissembling apparently through his wife, Barbara. Karl von Clausewitz, the famous Prussian military theoretician, discussed the achieving of victory in warfare as not only winning the war, but winning the post-war. And for our purposes here, Russ, I'm going to sort of assume the Kennedy assassination as something of an element of warfare. And on page 118, you note that after his conviction, Jack Ruby, his conviction subsequently was overturned on appeal, and then he died of cancer. But Jack Ruby, the assassin of alleged assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, gave an interview with reporters in which he said, among other things, as you write on page 118, "The people had that had so much to gain and had such an ulterior motive for putting me in the position I'm in will never let the true facts come above board to the world." Reporter, "Are these people in very high positions, Jack?" Ruby, "Yes." We might ask, qui bono, who benefited from this assassination? And in this regard, let's introduce some names to the audience, Russ, that will certainly be known to students of the Kennedy assassination and also older listeners, but perhaps not to younger people. Names like Hunt, Murchison, Meekum, Richardson, the Bass brothers, people you refer to as the Texas Raj. How do they figure in the political rise of George H.W. Bush, Poppy Bush, in the post-Camelot?
Well, I mean, basically, in this period, Texas was very much rising to become an independent power fiefdom in the United States, rivaling the East Coast establishment. And what you saw in Texas was a mix of people who had grown up poor there and had made their fortune as oil wildcatters, as well as another group who were very much East Coasters themselves, like the Bushes, and who had relocated there. And in Midland, Texas, where H.W. Bush, Poppy Bush, lived for a number of years and where George W. grew up, the streets were actually named Princeton, Yale, Harvard, and so forth, indicating very much the provenance of so many of the wealthy people who made up the elite in that town. But in any case, these great oil fortunes, the so-called independent oilmen in Texas, became a tremendous power center, and they exerted a huge amount of influence, not just on their own members of Congress, but also on presidents. And of course, you had Lyndon Baines Johnson, vice president from Texas, and you had him, and then he became president of the United States. And then we saw George H.W. Bush and then George W. Bush. So Texas became more and more important. The other element that was going on there was the rise of a very significant military industrial operation in the city of Dallas, described extensively in one chapter of Family of Secrets, and the coalescence also of a group of staunchly anti-communist white Russian emigres in this area. And so you had all of these interests coming together, all of them set of course upon an aggressive stance with the Soviets, all of them expressing a great deal of animosity for Jack and Robert Kennedy and for some of the things that they were trying to do. Again, in Family of Secrets, I have an entire chapter going through some of these sorts of initiatives on the parts of the Kennedys that was angering all of these various groups and essentially bringing them together in a powerful coalition to stop what they were doing.
In the very first of our interviews, we talked briefly about the networking between conservative Texas Democrat Lyndon Baines Johnson, of course, eventually president, and George H.W. Bush, eventually vice president and president, as LBJ had become. Develop that further for us, if you would, the relationship between LBJ and George H.W. Bush, because in the mid and latter part of the 60s, this began to develop further before LBJ was driven from office.
This is one of the many things that astonished me as I did my research for Family of Secrets, was to even learn of this friendship. If you read the books on LBJ, if you read the books on H.W. Bush, there's nothing in there about that. But I learned that they were extremely close, that they shared political backers, that they did each other favors. And I describe in the book how George H.W. Bush actually hired a judge from a small county in Texas who'd been crucial in LBJ's disputed election to the presidency. They claimed that there was ballot box stuffing. George H.W. Bush actually gave this man a job in an office for his small oil company in, of all places, Medellin, Colombia. But there were many other things going on. Brown and Root, a very important contractor and also military contractor that was, I would say, the principal funder of LBJ's political career, also was a key funder of George H.W.'s career, and very influential with both men. And I think sort of the icing on the cake, and it really tells it all, is that although Poppy Bush was very much a partisan Republican and would attack Johnson, and particularly Kennedy Johnson, publicly, when Richard Nixon was elected president, and right at the time of the inauguration festivities, of which Bush was participating, he left briefly to go to the airport and to quietly say goodbye to LBJ. And that's very, very unusual to do something like that for an active Republican, to leave the festivities for the leader of his party having been elected to the White House and to go and to see off the leader of the opposite party. But that was an indication of how close that relationship was. And that had to do with the fact that party labels just didn't mean a lot. That although Texas originally had a populist slash liberal wing of the Democratic Party, very much the Democratic Party became increasingly conservative. And then you had a Republican Party, and there really was just not a huge difference between the two.
One of the things, but we're going to get to Richard Nixon, who occupies a nice chunk of your book in a second. But you know that in 1966, George H.W. Bush, Poppy Bush, was elected to Congress, and you note that he occupied a very key position on the House Ways and Means Committee. That's something a lot of the audience may have heard of, but they don't realize its significance. Develop that for us, if you would, please, Russ.
Right. Well, Ways and Means dealing with taxes. This was very important to the oil industry, and particularly to the so-called independent oil industry based in Texas and Oklahoma and so forth. They were very concerned about protecting something called the oil depletion allowance, which enabled them to realize tremendous profits. And so it was a high priority for them to protect that, and it was a high priority for some people, including some presidents, to look at that as a sort of a dubious giveaway. And so when George H.W. Bush, as a freshman, was appointed to Ways and Means, and this was almost unheard of, his father, former Senator Prescott Bush, was very influential in twisting arms and getting his son on the committee. And so what this did was this gave the oil industry kind of an inside advantage. And that really, I think, also helped boost Bush's fortunes tremendously, because he was in the catbird seat there. He was the first freshman appointed to that committee in something like a half a century. So this was quite a big deal.
And, of course, Kennedy was moving to deplete the oil depletion allowance, and that was one of many things that outraged the Texas Raj, as you allude to them. You were talking about Prescott Bush and his influence in getting Poppy Bush on the House Ways and Means Committee. Some of the networking, and again, a lot of people disparage the sorts of relationships that you talk about here as conspiracy theory. What you're talking about is networking, something that is at the fundamental level of all power structure, really matters economic and social. Networking between the Bushes, the deep networking, to coin a term, between the Bush family and someone who's going to occupy a very prominent role in our future discussions of Family of Secrets, the Bush dynasty, America's invisible government, and the hidden history of the last 50 years, and that is Richard Nixon. Tell us about the genesis of Richard Nixon politically and how the Bushes appear to figure in that.
Well, Dave, this is another thing that astonished me. There are so many revelations that I came upon in my research for Family of Secrets that I started to think, my gosh, is any of our official history right? Are any of those books by those famed and, you know, hallowed historians right? And these great journalists, are they, you know, what is going on? Because every story that I had heard growing up, or that I had known as an adult, the so-called story of Watergate, the story of what happened to John F. Kennedy, just on and on and on. These things turned out to be myths. And so here's another one, Richard Nixon. I began, just as I had never intended to look at the Kennedy assassination when researching the Bush family, and only really stumbling on a connection which was so unavoidable that I had to go there, the same thing happened with Nixon. Once I established that Poppy Bush, George H.W. Bush, had a background in intelligence work for many, many years, And once I established that he had this sort of secret background, I was very interested in his rise to the presidency. And so I began studying that. And one of the things that struck me was how Richard Nixon had gone out of his way to help Bush. And Nixon was not prone to doing that. And I cite in Family of Secrets something on one of the lesser-known tapes where he's actually talking about Bush. And he talks about the fact that he's suggesting maybe sending him on a special mission overseas. And Kissinger dismisses it and says, no, come on, he's a lightweight. And then Nixon said, yeah, you're right. You're right. But Nixon clearly felt some sort of obligation that he needed to keep tasking him with things that were going to benefit him. In fact, that's also described in Family of Secrets, how this was very clear to Nixon's staff that he felt, he actually said at one point that he wanted to make Bush the ambassador to the UN because it would be helpful to him on his resume. Now, that's sort of crazy on its face because presidents don't do that. They either appoint people who they think will be helpful to them or advancing their policy, or because they owe somebody a favor. A lot of the ambassadors are wealthy campaign contributors. But in this case, he literally just said, no, I want to help this guy out. And I wondered, why would he help him out? And why would you help this particular guy out? And Nixon, of all people, who was so susceptible to whims and dropping people at a second's notice, he remained loyal to Bobby Bush. And so I began trying to figure that out, and I began trying to figure out where the relationship began, and I ended up going back year by year by year by year until I was all the way back in 1946 at the very start of Nixon's political career. And I'll just briefly sketch this, but I hope your listeners will take the time to read that chapter in Family of Secrets, which is about particularly the past of Richard Nixon, which is missing from all of the biographies of him. And this is about how he got his start. The official story that was put out was that Richard Nixon got his start as a small town in a small town in California, supported by small town businessmen who were frustrated with a great liberal who was the congressman from that district, a man named Jerry Voorhees. But what I discovered was that Prescott Bush and his partners in the investment banking firm of Brown Brothers Harriman were actually operating in that district at that time, gobbling up defense contracting firms, and were doing business with the Chandler family that were the owners of, at the time, the arch-right-wing Los Angeles Times, which became key sponsors of Richard Nixon's political career. But the most interesting thing I discovered was that Jerry Voorhees, it wasn't that he was so much a liberal on a general level, it was that Jerry Voorhees was on Capitol Hill a leading light when it came to investigating political influence and the power of financial elites, particularly Wall Street and the insurance companies. And he was calling hearings. He was concerned. This was in the aftermath of the Great Depression. He was concerned that we did not have proper regulation of these banking and investment interests. And his activities were of great concern and even alarm to these Wall Street circles. And so you actually see in an obscure writing by Voorhees, he says that in 1946, he got wind of the fact that there was an investment banker from the East Coast who was in town trying to get someone to run against him. And as I point out in Family of Secrets, all the evidence points to that investment banker being none other than Prescott Bush, the father of George H.W., grandfather George W. Bush. And so there you see the likelihood that the Bush family and the interests that they represented actually chose Richard Nixon, put him into politics, and basically owned him. And they owned him for decades. And his rise was engineered by them. The fact that he rose very quickly from the House to the Senate and very quickly from the Senate to the vice presidency and then on to a presidential bid in 1960. And in Family of Secrets, in the photo gallery, which is one of my favorite parts of the book, you see a picture of Prescott Bush with Richard Nixon, and they're wearing Panama hats, but you see Prescott Bush is toying with Nixon, and Nixon is grinning in a sort of embarrassed way, and I think that picture just about says it all, that it wasn't Nixon telling Senator Prescott Bush what to do, it was the other way around.
You also mentioned the Dresser Industries, the firm that figures so prominently in the concatenation stretching from Brown Brothers through Zapata Petroleum, Zapata Offshore Petroleum, also figures in with the Chandler's relationship with Prescott Bush and that milieu. Tell us a little bit about what Richard Nixon, we've already touched on what Richard Nixon actually did for George H.W. Bush, but let's go into some detail about the political appointments that that George H.W. Bush received from Richard Nixon, a man whose political destruction he ultimately helped to engineer.
Well, sure, there were two different things going on. First of all, 1966, Bush gets elected to the House of Representatives, gets this prime spot on Ways and Means, and by 1968, he is already wanting to be, are you ready, the Vice President of the United States. Richard Nixon, having lost his bid for the presidency in 1960, is now back in 1968 as the heir apparent, likely to win, and he's picking a vice president. And in Family of Secrets, I described this fascinating lobbying campaign where there's tremendous pressure being applied by some of the biggest corporations in America, saying, Nixon, you need to put Bush on the ticket with you. And this is, again, astonishing. This isn't in the books. How and why was this going on? To take a man that very few people had heard of, had limited political skills, why would they pressure to put him on the ticket? It was very simple. Was that this guy was their man. He was working for these powerful elite interests, and they wanted to be able to control Nixon. And I think there already was a sense that Nixon really, in a way, resented them. In any case, Nixon did not take their advice. Instead, he chose Spiro Agnew, and there's a wonderful statement he once made where he said that he considered Spiro Agnew to be his insurance against assassination. And that's very interesting. Although people may have taken that comment lightly, as I point out in Family of Secrets, Richard Nixon himself was in Dallas on November 22, 1963. Very, very odd that he should have been there at all. And I go through the backstory of how he came to be there, that in fact he was placed in Dallas by the head of Pepsi-Cola, a man with extensive ties into U.S. intelligence operations overseas, including the effort to remove Salvador Allende in Chile, who was causing problems for his company. And this man was also a very good friend of the Bush family.
That, by the way, is a Mr. Kendall. Go ahead.
And so he arranged for Richard Nixon to be in Dallas that day. And, of course, there's Nixon. And not only is he there, but Nixon is encouraged to hold a press conference, even though he's supposedly there working for Pepsi. He's encouraged to hold a press conference. He holds a press conference, and he attacks Kennedy and Johnson. And he actually says, from what I understand, I know they're here today and for their, you know, for their motorcade and so forth. But from what I understand, before the re-election in 1964, Kennedy is going to get rid of LBJ, drop him from the ticket. Now, this was an explosive thing to say in Texas, where the fact of having LBJ on the ticket was crucial to Kennedy in being able to gain the electoral votes of that state, which he needed in a close re-election battle, if there was going to be one. And so here was Nixon very much putting himself out there. This has been completely forgotten, but I found a newspaper clipping from the day of the assassination. Was an item in the paper, Richard Nixon holding this, I guess it was a press conference, it was a hotel room, and making these statements about Kennedy and Johnson. And so some hours later, right after the assassination, Nixon had just returned to New York, where he was then living, and he looked like he had seen a ghost. Not only shocked, of course, about the shooting, but somehow traumatized by the fact that he himself, the man who Kennedy had defeated in 1960, and therefore someone with purported animus toward the president, should himself be in the city when the president was shot. And so he was just blown away by this, pardon the expression. And so years later, he makes this remark that Spiro Agnew is his assassination insurance. So he does not choose Poppy Bush to run with him, but instead he offers him a consolation prize pretty soon. He encourages him to run for the U.S. Senate from Texas. as I point out in Family of Secrets, Bush and his father later figure out that Nixon doesn't really want him to win, is perfectly happy working with some conservative Democrats there, and may have secretly backed the Democrat Lloyd Benson instead. Lloyd Benson running to the right of Bush, actually is even more conservative, though he was a Democrat. And so 1970, Bush is bitter about this. He's bitter at Nixon, but Nixon comes along and says, hey, how'd you like to be the ambassador to the United Nations? Or perhaps I should say Bush proposes that he be ambassador to the United Nations. Now, this again is not correctly rendered in the histories that are out there. It's presented as that it was Nixon's idea, but it was not. And actually, Bush wrote a note to Nixon and said, I can be helpful to you as ambassador to the UN in New York. And the reason he gives, amazingly, is not because of any knowledge of foreign affairs, but he says, I can be useful to you in the social circles and the party circuit in New York. And, of course, he's playing to the fact that Nixon was very insecure about his own outsider status with these elites, and he knew the Bushes were very much part of that world. Whatever the reason was, he felt compelled to do it. He puts Bush into this extremely sensitive position. 1970, of course, everything is going on in the Middle East, in Indochina, with the Soviets, with the Chinese, and on and on and on. A very sensitive and important position. Instead of choosing somebody with a lot of experience in foreign affairs, he chooses Bush, who has basically none. And that gets him on the road to the presidency. So he points him to that. And then at the height of Watergate in 1973, when Nixon most needed someone he could count on, a very high-profile position, he chooses as the chairman of the Republican National Committee none other than George H.W. Bush. And so he's getting higher and higher visibility. He's setting himself up on a path to the top.
And ultimately, and we'll go into this probably in our next interview, as we see, what Richard Nixon was really doing by selecting George H.W. Bush to be head of the RNC was clasping the proverbial asp to his bosom from a professional standpoint. And also, when we talk about Watergate, so many of these people track back to the Bay of Pigs thing, as Richard Nixon put it when he was expressing what he was worried about if they went ahead and released the Watergate tapes. A couple of quick notes. Mr. Kendall, the head of PepsiCo, who helped to maneuver Richard Nixon down to Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, also very much involved with matters Cuban as well as the intelligence community because of the primacy of sugar and the Cuba in the sugar industry, and obviously PepsiCola, Coca-Cola, got to have a lot of sugar in there. So they were not at all disinterested in matters Cuban as well. One of the things that you talk about, well, you know, we've got just a little over a minute left, Russ. We're going to be talking about some of the deep networking that continued, that was taking place in this time period. And we're also going to introduce how George W. Bush was helping to keep the skies of Texas safe from enemy attack during the Vietnam War. Very quickly, George Bush took a trip during the Christmas break to Vietnam in 1967 with a very interesting individual. You speculate about that. We can continue on side two with this, but who is he traveling with and what do you think he was doing there?
Well, at this point, George H.W. Bush, Poppy Bush, was then a congressman, and he took with him a man named Thomas Devine. And as I report earlier in Family of Secrets, I discovered that the creation of Zapata Offshore, this early and very peculiar a drilling company that looked to be an intelligence front, was created by Bush with the help of Mr. Devine, who had until just then been an officer of the Central Intelligence Agency.
We have been speaking with Russ Baker, the author of Families of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years, just out in softcover by the Bloomsbury Press. And if you want to know more about it, just stay tuned for side two of our interview, or better yet, go buy the book. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 713, interview with Russ Baker. This has been recorded on Memorial Day weekend, May 31st. On Memorial Day, May 31st, of 2010. For Russ Baker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.